Welcome to this Friday night radio program. Brother Michael Diamond here, also with Brother Peter Diamond. We'll be bringing on our special guest, Mr. Gregory Safried. He was a pastoral administrator for two different Novus Ordo churches up in the Diocese of New Ulm, Minnesota. And he's going to share with us some of his experiences and some of the horrible things that he unfortunately witnessed at these Novus Ordo churches, and also going to different Novus Ordo seminaries and witnessing some very interesting things. And we'll be talking to him about some of his experiences. And I think we're ready to bring him on. And Gregory, are you with us now?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yes. I think, first of all, now maybe we can bring people up to date. You actually just resigned as the pastoral administrator just, what, a few days ago, actually, right?
Yes, I was a pastoral administrator for two parishes in the Novus Ordo setup here in western Minnesota.
Sure. And you actually, how long ago did you actually find out about our website you actually had?
Yes, I ran across it maybe about a year ago or so.
Okay. And so you were sort of looking at all this. One of the things I actually found interesting in our conversation a few days ago when we were speaking is that you actually, I think, went to many different Novus Ordo seminaries over the years, I guess, right?
Yes, several of them.
When you first actually asked about a vocation, I think you were telling me you went to your local diocesan priest to speak to him about the possibility of a vocation. And maybe you could share with the people what he actually recommended, for you to do. Yeah.
A priest a couple years ago actually asked me, in the throes of the whole pedophile scandal, what I thought of it. And I said, well, I wasn't really surprised because way back in the mid-70s, when I first knocked on the door of my vocation director back in the Diocese of Lansing, Michigan, he had me summed up even back then as a rigid arch-traditionalist or something like that, whatever that was back then. Rigid was a word that they threw around a lot. Maybe they still do, I don't know. And to remedy the situation, I was to go and buy a Playboy magazine and then go on a sin strip in my hometown and engage the services of a prostitute and actually almost come back with her recommendation. This is something that he actually told me to do.
That's just amazing. So he actually recommended for you to read Playboy magazine and go out and see a prostitute.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then after having heard that advice, I went to see the bishop of the place. And while he wasn't too crazy about the prostitute idea, he did think the Playboy suggestion was good.
Wow, that's
this from a so-called bishop,
Wow.
And
what was his name? Do you remember?
Kenneth Pavish. He's now deceased. He was originally the Bishop of Crookston, Minnesota. Then they transferred him over to Lansing for I think 20 long years. When he presided over the decay and spiritual decline of that diocese.
And what position did the one who recommended the prostitute, what position is, I don't know, is he still alive or?
As far as I know, we've had no contact. He was the vocation director at the time.
So he was actually the vocation director for what, the whole diocese?
Yes, uh-huh, right.
And do you know how long he was the vocation director?
Oh, I would say probably around 10 years, anyway, if memory serves.
And so he probably was recommending this to every person that was coming. Maybe not every person, but...
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, liberals and people who agreed with him, he probably didn't. He probably figured they already had done it.
Wow.
Me, of course, being an uptight conservative, rigid was the word that they always threw around, and this was going to remedy this. Well, not really, because even if I had gone and done it and did it, I didn't, of course, but he still wouldn't have liked me because he wouldn't have liked my ideas.
So you actually then, as far as you traveled around to some different seminaries, I guess? Or...
So I went off and I got my degree in philosophy, intending still to become a priest because that's what, you know, you're told to do. And I enjoyed the study of philosophy. I did well in it. And sooner or later, you know, ended up at Holy Apostles Seminary, which is not bad as seminaries go, at least when I was there in the mid-'80s. But what had happened, as frequently is the case, at least it used to be, whenever I would try another bishop, they would ask you where you're from, and I told them, you know, where I was from. So they would always pick up the telephone and call that vocation director and that bishop, and they would, you know, they would X me out. So not only was I never going to be a priest in that diocese, the Diocese of Lansing, I was never going to be a priest anywhere.
Just because you had a reputation as a conservative?
Yeah. So, you know, it's kind of like the good old boys network. If one of them puts the kibosh on you, it doesn't matter why, you know.
Was it because you went to the Holy Apostles Seminary up in Connecticut that was that or no?
Yeah, it could have been partly that. It was just that the bishop and the vocation director of that diocese was just determined that that I was never going to become a priest, and no matter who I contacted or where I went, they were going to say things that were negative. I mean, they actually lied, you know, very, very definitely about me, you know, and false accusations and things like that. And the church being a structure built on power, you know, as in large part it is, if that's the case, then, you know, you kind of get ground under the wheels of it. I see it as a blessing, you know, at coming down the road, because I wouldn't have wanted to be ordained into any of that anyway, looking back at it. But,
yeah.
You know, when you think of this is the kind of thing that, you know, people have contact with day in and day out in their parish churches, and, you know, not all vocation directors, I suppose, were like that, but I'm sure enough of them were. And so if you know, later on you have these... sexual scandals erupting in the church. You can see almost where it comes from, you know, at least in part. I mean, fallen human nature doesn't need any encouragement to sin, let alone having a priest or a bishop encouraging it, you know, on top of it all. And it was a part of a whole theological and philosophical package of you know, becoming human, that, you know, the denial of the supernatural, the denial of grace, the kind of collapsing of the supernatural into the natural, and making, you know, becoming a human, a full human person, and part of that is, you know, sexual experiences. So how in the world can you become a full human person, let alone a priest, unless you have all of these experiences behind you?
That's what they were saying, yeah.
Yeah, that's the idea behind it.
You were mentioning also that some of the classes that you took, they're actually... professors that were trying to deny the divinity of Christ. You're telling me one story about one particular teacher that was very upset because he couldn't get you to deny the divinity of Christ, I think.
Yeah. I studied at a place called Washington Theological Union when I was with a group called the Marist.
And where's that?
Washington, D.C.
Okay.
Washington Theological Union.
Oh, okay, Washington, D.C., okay.
And, you know, the professors of systematic theology, that's what they call it, rather than dogmatic theology, of course. And there wasn't one that was even remotely orthodox, but the chair of the department studied under Karl Rahner, who, you know, we all know is just a notorious apostate. And, you know, he said explicitly that there is no such thing as supernatural reality. Jesus is a man, only a man. You know, the resurrection, the physical, historical resurrection of Christ never occurred, et cetera, et cetera. And that the reason why the churches were empty in his mind was because we promoted this old idea of the supernatural that we inherited from Augustine, St. Augustine, and Thomas Aquinas, and we had to, you know, totally revolutionize theology a la Rahner. And I remember... This is a very intelligent man. This is no stupid dummy, you know. I mean, he knew the councils inside and out, Nicaea and Chalcedon, you know, the Christological councils and teaching emanating from them. He knew them as well as I'm sure he knew his name and every intimate detail about his own life. So it's not a problem or a matter of someone not knowing these things, but making a choice. But I can remember going to him. He had final exams that were scheduled, and they lasted an hour. He kept me close to 2 hours, and because I wouldn't give in to his bullying tactics with regards to this Renarian apostasy. I mean, he just his veins were bulging in his neck, and he was angry, and he was shouting at me. You know, I'm going to call your superior and tell him that, you know, you're not fit to be a priest. How in the world could you possibly ever, you know, lead people today? You know, the Vatican never sanctioned, you know, Karl Rahner. He was a preeminent voice at the Second Vatican Council. How dare you call him into question? Blah blah blah. I say to people, it was almost like having a final exam with the Antichrist. You know.
So when you saw this occurring, what were your thoughts about where this problem originated, or how far up it went?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was becoming so evident. I mean, I knew that the church was in very deep trouble, and I mean, the evidence of this was everywhere. This man, to me, seemed possessed, as many of them did. You know, I mean, you know, the characteristic of Antichrist is to deny and to dissolve Christ, and this is what he was doing. And I mean, it was just another symptom of a deep, deep, deep problem that existed in the church.
Did any of the other students feel similarly to you?
Well, you know, it's surprising how many of them are just very much like sheep and went along with it, thinking that this is the way it was. I spoke to a newly ordained priest when I was doing, you know, like parish ministry and that kind of thing, because you always went out to help out the parishes. That was part of the whole pastoral element of it all. And he went to Mount St. Mary's, which is one of the more conservative seminaries. And I was telling him, you know, what we were learning and what they wanted us to learn at this place. And he looked at me and he said, in his cassock and his, you know, conservative outlook, he said, well, if I would have heard that, that's what I would have believed, too.
Wow.
So you take these impressionable young men and you put them in a situation, and the peer pressure and the whole culture is so corrupt on top of it, and the desire to fit in, part and parcel of the clerical mentality, I think.
Well, yeah, if they're not rooted in a firm belief in the dogmas of the church.
No,
yeah.
No. They really bend to any wind of dogma. And the desperate attempt to fit in and to get ordained and to move ahead and to be accepted and to get positions of responsibility and those kinds of things are really overwhelming for many, many guys, you know. Even if maybe the Holy Spirit whispers into their heart and their soul that this is not right, if they have red flags, generally speaking, they have all kinds of authority figures that will, you know, tell them otherwise.
Yeah. One of the things we also wanted to ask you about were some of the things that you actually saw yourself over the years. Maybe we can actually take a call right now. Peter?
Yes.
You had a question or comment?
Yes. Good evening, Brother Michael,
Hi.
Brother Peter. Gregory, I have to ask you, because it just seems, you said it just seems so unbelievable, but when that priest told you to go get a Playboy magazine or a prostitute, you know, I just, and you say you're of a conservative nature, I mean, how did that just not make you run? And especially after it was like, after you went to their bishop with it, you know, how did you just not, hightail it out of there?
I guess what I thought was that this gave me greater incentive to stay in to try to change things and to battle it. I now look back and think that was mistaken. You know,
right.
It never
occurred to you that these people just didn't even, I mean, like, I don't know, that's just so bizarre. I can't even really, I understand it. As far as like this, it's not a Catholic, you know, it's not the Catholic Church, pure and simple. But to actually go that far and say something like that, it just seems like, I don't even know what to say. It just is like, it's so unbelievable that if a priest ever said that to me, and then it was confirmed by a bishop, you know, to go pick up a Playboy magazine, I don't know. I just, it's scary.
Yeah, well, it was you know, truly bizarre. I mean, there was other bizarre stuff that was going on in the diocese at the time, you know, and with the Newman Center there and things like that. I think once the faith breaks down in people's hearts, minds, and souls, once they relinquish dogma and they become modernists, then the result is almost anything. You know, I mean, there's no defense against any kind of strange and silly and stupid ideology,
right,
and philosophy.
So you just recently, as of a couple of days ago, you've left the Novus Ordo altogether?
Yeah, right.
So you are embracing them with these brothers are the material that they're putting out there is the true Catholic Church then.
Yes.
That's great. I mean, great to hear that. But this is like unbelievable hearing the stuff that you're talking about.
Yeah.
That's all I had to say. It's good. Well, it's good to have you back then, I guess.
Yeah. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Thanks, Peter from New York. Some of the questions. What are some of the things that you actually witnessed at the Novus Ordo Mass? Any things that come out immediately in your mind that you witnessed over the years, some of the sacrileges? And
well, I can't, you know, beat some of the stuff that's on your website. I've never seen a bishop wear a cheese head or that kind of thing. I mean, I've endured and suffered through the typical kind of stuff. I can remember, you know, being in a college setting, a so-called Catholic college when I was there, and sitting around in a circle, and the priest brings out a big piece of bread and allegedly consecrates it, and then, you know, breaks it apart, and crumbs are falling all over the place.
Just a big loaf of bread?
Just a big loaf of bread, yeah.
And you're all in a circle?
All in a circle, yeah.
Wow. What about the sign of peace? I know some places they start to, you know, hug each other, and I guess that's just common, I guess.
Yeah, that's really common. The priests do, you know, they have their idiosyncrasies. Around here, a priest was having the congregation say the latter part of the Eucharistic prayer after the so-called consecration. That was a common thing that you would see. But just the typical thing where, the priest would be on the altar, but everybody surrounding him would be a woman. So, you know, you have women ministers of the Eucharist, you have women minister lectors, you have women servers, you know, and the lone priest amongst all these women who are running him, almost, you know.
Wow.
You know, the way people dress and the typical kinds of things.
No dress code at all.
No dress code, you know, no sense of propriety, you know, a lot of emphasis on singing, you know, and this false notion of active participation of the council foisted upon everybody.
Did you see a much promotion of ecumenism and
interreligious? Yeah, the cult of man, the priest sitting in the middle of the sanctuary, the Masonic lodge look.
He would just sit. Oh, okay, sit in the chair. Okay,
in his chair.
In his chair, presider chair.
Presider chair.
Yeah,
yeah. He's a presider now. Yeah.
Did they ever preach on immorality? That, you know, the common sins that people commit today?
No, never. Absolutely never. Never. I've never heard in my whole time in this whole Novus Ordo thing, I've never heard one homily, or they call them homilies rather than sermons, you know, even against abortion.
Wow.
I've never heard it.
And that's how many years?
Well, you know, for the whole duration, you know, you're talking 40 years.
So in 40 years, you didn't hear one sermon, or homily as they call it now, against abortion?
No.
Or anything else?
Oh, let alone anything else.
Wow, that's
just amazing. I mean,
it's quite revealing.
That's just incredible. What about as far as did you ever see them bring in people from other, like, Lutherans, Methodists, other people?
The ecumenical element is very common, because the mentality has shifted to a notion of all religions are more or less equal. And you're bound to, in some sense, fraternize with the Baptists and the Methodists and the Free Church, evangelicals, and all these people. There's no sense of, we're the true church anymore, and to save your soul, you have to come in, that kind of thing. It's just a collaboration among equals. If anything, there would be a guilt trip that the church at one time thought of herself that way, and so now we're doing mea culpas all over the place. That kind of thing. So, the ecumenical element is more or less a given. You don't. That would be a part of the life of the church now.
Did their so-called ministers ever come into the Novus Ordo churches?
Yeah, there are prayer services that are held, especially during the unity,
January
Unity Prayer Week.
Sure.
That kind of thing. Yeah.
Wow. And I guess you're saying women on the altar was just you're saying actually almost every person outside of the so-called priest is a woman on the altar.
Well, virtually, usually, the way church life is it really is predominated by women.
Mm-hmm.
Women run it, and therefore they're the ones that end up on the altar doing all these things. Not exclusively, but largely. Older women, and you're talking about women who are probably at least in their 50s or 60s, who somehow or another have ended up as kind of like a class of people. A substratum of ecclesiastical personnel, could you say, that have kind of landed in these positions that do these jobs, all under the aegis of the title of, lay ministry and that kind of thing. In this diocese, before Bishop Nienstedt, there was Bishop Lucker, the notorious Bishop Lucker, and he always came out on a regular basis proclaiming how unjust it was, how unjust it is that the Catholic Church doesn't ordain women. So he was always proclaiming his desire to see women ordained, and therefore he put women into very crucial positions of authority. My predecessor at this pastoral administrator job was a nun, an old nun, that he had appointed, and most of them were, hoping that one day that these women would transition into the so-called priesthood.
Wow. Do you know much, or did you see much, of children's masses?
Oh, yeah. A total abomination is children's masses.
What exactly would you describe that as?
Yeah, it's like, it's worse than any kind of, entertainment facade that you'd see on television. They recently had first Holy Communion over here, and, a necessary thing in the Novus Ordo now to accentuate the man-centeredness, the person-centeredness of it all, is that they had all the kids have handprints put on a cloth, and they had hung that thing, believe it or not, on the altar.
Huh.
So all the kids, had their little handprints there, whatever that meant, and they had it hanging on the altar, and of course they have to be involved, and they have to go up there and read, and they have to do this, and they have to do that, because mommy just thinks it's so delightful to see little Johnny up there making a fool out of himself when he's reading or doing a prayer of the faithful or something like that. It's just horrible.
So they're just going right up to the altar at times and all kinds of...
So in witnessing all this, you have no trouble identifying this as the actual fulfillment of what is prophesied as the abomination of desolation.
Abomination of desolation. Oh, yeah.
You can really grasp it.
Yeah, in all its vivid reality and detail. Yeah.
Did they ever, I know they switched their confessions to, they would, confessions are by appointment only, maybe at some churches, I think they still have them on Saturday evening. What was the case in up there in Minnesota? Did they just have it by appointment? Did they ever hear confessions?
No, he had them scheduled on Saturday afternoon. Many of them do. But, because it's not encouraged, and for so many years, a lot of dioceses did Form 3, which is general absolution. The whole practice of individual regular confession has dropped down in dropped off, of course, because there's no sin anymore either. You know, people don't go to confession like they did. But a lot of times, you know, what would happen is if confessions will be scheduled at 4 o'clock, nobody comes in by 4:15, the priest is gone. You know?
Yeah.
The kind of sacramental theology that's pushed in the Novus Ordo seminaries are that, you know, there's no sense anymore of the ex opere operato. Sacraments just simply are manifestations, ecclesial manifestations of something that's already going on.
As Ratzinger says, that it's not the words of consecration that are necessary for a valid Eucharist, but
right.
The community.
Exactly. Yeah, there's a definite community aspect. And so the reason to do any sacrament is essentially to foster a communal atmosphere and element that God is somehow invited into and present to, however you understand God and the like. I think that really is the root of it, you know, the pushing of something called panentheism, which is just a kind of a variation of pantheism, of the so-called theologians that make the circuit around today that seminarians will study, you know, really dethrone God in favor of, you know, worship of self and the deification of self.
And so... Also, when the people would receive, quote, communion, I guess most of the people probably took it in the hand.
Yeah.
It was probably all over the place. There are probably all kinds of sacrileges, obviously, that...
Oh, yeah. I found you know, wafers in the missalettes.
Wow.
Wow, that's something. Did they also give the wine to everybody?
Yeah. That was another thing. That's almost like... If you don't do that, it's almost like...
you haven't received.
Right.
How about musically? Did you see polka masses and rock music?
The music is horrible. I mean, it's beyond horrible. I mean, you wouldn't hear it on the radio, you know.
I mean, okay, well, what kinds of things are you talking about?
You mean musically?
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's this whole cadre of music that's been produced by people like Marty Haugen and David Hurd and other strange. I always tried to not even notice because it was all so horrible. There's a song that's particularly egregious. It's called "Gather Us In," that they all love and they've been singing now for 10 years. And there's no mention of God in it at all. It just exalts the community and the people. You know, there's a phrase in there, a line: "We have been sung throughout all eternity." Talking about the community.
Huh, that's interesting. That's very interesting.
It speaks of light coming in. Well, you know, Lucifer is the light bearer. And I've brought this up to people, you know, and it's just like blinders. There's scales over these people's eyes. When you point out that, you know, there's no reference to God in here, there's only a reference to us, and that's largely what the music is, you know, or it's very trite. The melodies are very trite. They're melodies that nobody would buy in the secular world to play anything with. It's the whole thing to some extent is condescending. I mean, besides squandering the treasury of the church as far as Gregorian chant or Latin or anything, it's not even good secular music. Not that I'm an expert, but it's all just meant to demean and to displace the church and to make it look ridiculous, I think.
And so you could really see the emphasis on man.
Yes.
That's
what it's all about.
Yeah. Wow. And so when you tried to tell the people about some of these things that you saw that were, you know, troubling to you, they just generally just didn't care. And I think you were telling me over the phone that most of the people just felt, well, my mom came to this church, my grandfather came to this church, and that's where I'm going, and not even thinking about any of these issues, right?
No, they don't think about these issues. You know, the whole idea of a valid sacrament, for instance, is totally gone. You know, I mean, if you sit and you try to make the case, as you do, you know, for you know, the lack of validity as far as holy orders is concerned, and the lack of attention and form at mass and all that. I mean, it's like, you know, like they look at you like, well, so who cares?
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, another particularly obnoxious element to this now, as far as ministers are concerned, all these churches have greeters. And so when you walk into the door, you know, you're inundated by these people who are there, you know, sticking their hands out, smiling and saying, good morning, how are you? Welcome to the Church of St. Ipsy Dipsy or whatever. You know, you can't just go in and feel the presence of God and the transcendent and the holy. You have to be, the first thing you're in contact with is man, people.
Mm-hmm. You know? Interesting.
And you have to make nice and smooth with these people. And there's an attempt to bring more and more of this into the situation because they think that people are not coming to church because of a lack of hospitality. The Novus Ordo actually has seminars on this stuff. You know, I've had to go to pastoral leadership days where the topic is hospitality. And if we're just nicer and we just smile more and we're more amicable to people, then that's going to bring them all in. See? And that's the ridiculous mentality that they have. And so, you know, as the church dies and crumbles around their noses, they remain clueless in the face of these horrible things.
What about, I was just actually speaking to someone from the Maryland area, and she said that at these Novus Ordo churches, virtually every single Novus Ordo church has altar girls.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That's basically, it's universal?
That's universal now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so not only do you have women all over the altar, but you also have altar girls?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have altar girls.
At every Novus Ordo mass?
Yeah, I mean, what they generally do, see, because this provides for certain problems. Someone was telling me not too long ago that they walked into the sacristy, they opened up a cupboard, and there was a boy server and a girl server in there, doing a little hanky panky, should we say?
Oh man!
You know that it you know, rather than encourage
this just happened recently.
Yeah, I would say I heard about this maybe within the last couple months or so. But, you know, in their attempt to try to foster vocations, you know, servers, altar boys were always an area in which they, you know, they depended upon a kind of a flow of people into the seminary from the servers, from the ranks of the servers. Well, now, you know, because technically still you can't have women priests, you have women altar girls, though. And it kind of raises all these conflicting notions with regard to, you know, why are they there? And the boys really don't want to serve with the girls, and the girls don't want to serve with the boys. So they usually, you know, kind of cordon them off so that one week the girls will serve, and the next week the boys will serve. But they usually don't mix them. Sometimes
so,
they do.
So it's about 50-50?
Yeah. I would say so. In some places, really the girls predominating. I would say at these parishes here, I would say it's kind of 50-50. I think at the bigger parish that I was in charge of, there were actually more altar girls.
Wow. We talked to one young girl who went to a so-called Catholic high school, and she told me that after 4 years of, quote, Catholic high school, she had not been taught the concept of mortal sin. She had never even heard of it in 4 years of, quote, Catholic education. Does that sound like something similar to what you would experience?
Oh, absolutely. I've fought many battles over the area of catechetics, which is just atrocious. They have, in this area now, see, they have one DRE, one Director of Religious Education over five parishes. And she's running something called the GIFT program, Growing in Faith Together. There's a big emphasis in trying to incorporate parents into all of this. And they're running around and they're doing this and they're doing that and they're doing that. Well, the diocese sent out something called the Aker test, which in and of itself isn't too great, but it does try to measure to some degree the concrete knowledge that students have through 11 years of either Catholic education or CCD or something like that. And the average in this, I averaged the scores, and the average score in this area was like 56 or 58%. You know, basic doctrinal moral, you know, questions about the commandments, about the church, that these kids had no knowledge of whatsoever. You know, that anybody would have taken this test would have flunked it.
Huh.
And most of them did. So this doesn't bother them, you know. But they have these speakers that come in from around. They're supposed to be motivational primarily, I guess. And, you know, from various Catholic, so-called Catholic colleges and all that. One worse than the other. I mean, they were just horrible speakers. And, you know, if you were to confront them about this, you know, what the bottom line is that it really doesn't matter what they say. What really matters is that you get them out and you get them together and you get them into community and that they, you know, they have a soup supper beforehand and they do things like that. See, so it's really a diabolical mentality. And it has totally destroyed the church, this whole emphasis on catechetics that is essentially experiential in nature rather than doctrinal. And it's just a trickle down from the corruption of the higher institutions, you know, like the seminaries and the institutions of so-called higher learning in the Catholic Church that are modernistic and promote modernism and apostasy.
Very interesting that you mentioned the experiential aspect of this, because Pope St. Pius X, in describing the doctrine of the modernists, he specifically labels their perversion of tradition, their perversion of their notion of tradition, as turning it into something that is truth handed down, into something that is experienced.
Right.
And so you saw that firsthand.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's modernism. It's what Pius X did condemn, Pascendi, the idea that, you know, there's this religious element, this experiential element, and that's the thing that's important. The secondary doctrinal aspects are merely cultural, and they vary from religion to religion. And
Wow,
that's really something. What about as far as, did you ever find out or hear about the sex education programs that they had, these perverted programs that these apostate bishops have for the little children?
Yeah, I've not had much contact personally with it. I know parents who have fought battles over it and have lost. You know, again, it stems from the same mentality. You know, it stems from the notion that what has replaced a truly Catholic and Christian understanding of human sexuality is this secular, you know, really diabolical notion of experience and having to a holistic idea of what the human person is that radically departs from, you know, the Catholic idea and this kind of thing. I see it as all just kind of like a systematic whole. You know, one part of it, one link of it breaks, and then the other just kind of goes along with it at all.
And so you would see these parents try to fight and say, I don't want my kids to be instructed in this garbage, and they lost virtually every time.
Oh, yeah. You always lose because it's fundamentally a power struggle. The apostates are in power. They're in charge. And they like nothing more than to see people go down with the ship. I mean, you know, I tell people, you know, even though it's that their instinct is always to go and to fight and everything else like that, you know, I've fought enough battles to know that you don't win. You have to leave. They almost feed on the fact that people write them and get confrontational, and it's a really distorted view of human nature. Their whole reaction to any kind of eyebrow lifting, let alone confrontation with regard to any of this stuff. They want it the way they want it. They don't want to hear any kind of negative input, and if they do, they'll destroy you if they can.
What about it, as far, I was going to ask you also, the charismatic movement. I know in certain places they almost completely dominate the activity, or the persons who are the most active at these different parishes are usually charismatic, quote, Catholics. Was that the same case where you were?
Well, not so much here. I have seen that, though. I have seen that many times.
Speaking in tongues. Do you ever see them, quote, speaking in tongues?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And the real trip is to hear them singing in tongues.
Singing in tongues?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you'll never hear anything more spooky and devilish sounding than when they're all...
Wow.
There's a whole church full of charismatics, and they're singing in tongues.
Wow.
And, you know, they I've seen them go into parishes and actually set up their own hierarchy over and above the priests, you know, the clergy there. And of course, the priests allow this thing. they have their own sacraments, in a sense. They have their own oils, and they anoint people, and they have their own, processes of initiation into their groups, and they, like you say, they sing in tongues, and they do their healing services, and all this takes precedence over the sacramental life of the church. The same thing with any of these movements. I grew up in a parish where the Curcio was very active. And talk about being divisive. If you weren't a part of the Curcio or approved of the Curcio, then you were a second or a third class Catholic. And one of the worst things that the Charismatic Renewal did, along with these other movements, was to foster this elitism and this tier system within a parish, and making it kind of the determining factor as to who is in and who is out, and who's spiritual and who's not. You babbled in tongues, and you were among the chosen, and of course, if you could interpret tongues, you were even better because you had a special gift, and the like. So, whichever way you turn, there are abuses on all ends and atrocities for every taste and personality, I guess you would say.
Interesting. So maybe you could tell us now about when it was that you came across the information that led you to conclude that the Novus Ordo Mass is not valid, and what particular teachings of the Church or facts caused you to come to the correct conclusions on these issues?
Well, I mean, I guess I've always tried to, I mean, in the midst of it all, I've always prayed. I spend a great deal of time in prayer every day, and I just kept asking God, asking our Lord to show me what the problem is. I knew that there was always something very wrong, but there was something in me that just wouldn't allow me to see the actual truth as the way it stood. And then actually it was coming across your website that really crystallized it for me, and watching the videos.
Was this just on a search? Or?
I'm sorry?
Was this just on a random web search that you did?
Yeah, okay. More or less.
Uh-huh.
And finally just actually came down on me like a ton of bricks. Well, obviously the sacraments aren't valid. That's why there's no faith. That's why there's no observance. That's why all these bizarre things are going on.
So it made perfect sense to you from what you had been witnessing.
Right, it made sense to me. Mm-hmm. Right.
Did you hear about any of these things over the years? I mean, were you aware of John Paul II's interreligious prayer meetings or anything like that?
Only vaguely.
Vaguely.
Yeah.
Okay. Did you think that he was sort of maybe trying to convert these people when he was on these trips, maybe in a different way than some other people would go about doing it, and you didn't read his material? I know a lot of people, haven't read John Paul II when he was alive, or Benedict XVI now.
Yeah.
And so you didn't really know exactly what they were saying, even.
Right. I think there's kind of a conspiracy of cover-up to some extent.
Yeah, there is.
EWTN, I mean, they'll never show you that.
They'll show you certain aspects of it, like they'll mention that he's holding this meeting in Assisi, but then they stop their filming when he breaks them up into the different rooms.
Right. And then I can remember like reading, Redemptor Hominis, and you'd come to one of those passages where you think to yourself, now what is he saying there? And I can just remember myself, something in me almost saying, I don't know that I want to know. And then I would go and I would read further. Or tell myself something like, this man's very smart. He's above me, and I don't quite know what this passage means. It doesn't seem like it's in alignment with what previous popes have said and that kind of thing. And to read his stuff anyway, generally speaking, was very tedious because he, the verbiage in his massive amount of writings. Almost everybody always admitted that, even heretics and others, even conservatives, even some of his friends would say, this man just puts out all this prodigious amount of verbiage, and we don't know even what to make of it all. And some of these enigmatic statements about identifying Christ with all humanity and dissolving Christ in 6 billion different components. you know, his universalism and this kind of stuff. When you actually sit down and you read it and you see it for what it is, it's so appalling, and it's such a shock. And there's no other conclusion that you can possibly come to, really, you know.
Yeah. Once you see the facts, there's no denying it for an honest person.
Right.
Was there a particular article or set of information that hit you first and most powerfully, such as maybe the information on the invalidity of the new mass? Or?
Yeah. That was a large part of it. See, in the Novus Ordo Seminary, they get around this whole thing by trying to teach you why the anaphoras of Adi and Mari are valid.
They covered that in the seminary?
Oh, yeah. There was practically a whole semester on that.
Wow.
As this explanation as to why they're valid, even though there aren't words of institution in it.
Wow, that must have been recently, because I think that was, 2001 that Ratzinger approved of that people could attend those schismatic.
Yeah, it was right around
that
time.
Okay.
Just so our listeners know what we're talking about, this is a schismatic liturgy that has no words of consecration. And in the discussions about whether Catholics can go to this schismatic liturgy that necessarily arise when you're talking about the ecumenism of the Vatican II sect, the question came up, well, can they go here? It's different from your normal schismatic liturgy because it actually doesn't have any words of consecration at all. And after studying it, Ratzinger concluded, with the approval of John Paul II, that it's actually valid, even though it has no words of consecration. So they're actually teaching that this liturgy is valid without words of consecration in the seminary, and he heard it. And Ratzinger speaks of it in a number of his books.
Yeah. And it's an Eastern schismatic liturgy. So, yeah. I mean, it's not even an Eastern, you know, Byzantine Rite Church liturgy that has no words of consecration. It's on top of having no words of consecration. It's a schismatic liturgy, and they're saying, oh, yeah, you can go to it, and it's valid.
Did they get into any of the details why they think it's valid, or not really?
Well, they'll tell you that there's an epiclesis, you know, an epiclesis, and that the whole atmosphere, the sacred atmosphere, will affect and confect the Eucharist in spite of whether or not there are words of consecration there. That's what they say. And in a more crass explanation, they'll say, well, it's really, you know, the community that does it anyway. But it's you know, they'll tell you, well, it's magic to sit there and say, well, you say certain words over a piece of bread, then it becomes the Eucharist. You know?
Wow.
I mean, that's the way it was explained to us. That, you know, the consecration happens, but you can't isolate a particular moment in time when it happens. It happens within the context of the whole sacred event.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that to some extent, the whole discussion, almost the whole semester's worth of discussion on this, was really done to eventually justify the Novus Ordo in its lack of form. I mean, that wasn't stated explicitly, but, you know, the attempt to justify those anaphoras, you know, in the schismatic liturgy, you know, would justify what the Novus Ordo does.
Interesting. One other question I wanted to ask you is getting back to that seminary professor you were disputing with about the divinity of Christ. When you raised the issue, I'm not sure if you did, about the dogmatic definitions of the early councils on the divinity of Christ, did he address that or just dismiss them?
Well, he would say that that human thought and civilization and philosophy has progressed away from a realist perspective of things to a more existential notion. In other words, historical and philosophical truths, you know, they progress and they change. That it was true for them for that time, but now we're above that, we're beyond that. Theologians no longer accept a static notion of reality. Now we progressed into a dynamic understanding of what the truth is.
Okay, yeah. Just the pure modernistic explanation.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he recommended to me that I study the philosopher Heidegger, you know, of all people, which I'm sure I did at some point in time, but it's just a notion, a totally different notion of reality, see? And what they do is they say that in the past people had a static notion of reality, thingness, you know, the antiquated notion of substance and accident and all of that. But now, you know, we progressed away from that to a knowledge of things in kind of total flux and meaning. You know, the meaning that people back in the time of Nicaea 325 had with regards to Christ is no longer the meaning that we attribute to him today, because of our advance in scientific knowledge, the advances in the theological arts, blah, blah, blah. So they have an answer for everything. And that's why it can be so captivating and so seducing with regards to young minds who walk into a place like that. You know, and, you know, you have all these authority figures, so-called priests and all, who advance the same theories, who are of the same mindset. And so, you know, you're going to produce something that's very, very different from traditional Catholicism.
Did you see that? I know that I had one person that I know when he went to confession to a Novus Ordo priest, and this priest told him, "For your penance, go talk to a tree." Any things like that that you heard about? Priests giving all kinds of wacky forms of penance?
Well, yeah, I've not heard too much along those lines. I do know that they oftentimes don't even give a valid absolution. I mean, I've been in situations like that where they don't even say I absolve you.
Oh, really? What would they say?
Oh, Christ forgives you, or I forgive you, or your sins are forgiven, or something like that.
Wow.
You know.
What about as far as some people have actually said that in a lot of these churches that it's almost impossible if you want to receive, quote, communion from the priest or so-called priest, that people are talking about they have to go in and walk all over the place to get around all these Eucharistic ministers. Is it sometimes even difficult for people even to get actually, quote, communion from the priest?
Oh, yeah. Usually what you have is you have this whole hassle of extraordinary ministers. They don't even call them extraordinary anymore. They're ministers of the Eucharist, and usually parishes will have them, you know, sent out to people at homes or in senior residences or hospitals or whatever to bring the Eucharist, you know. The Novus Ordo would still, of course, say, for, I think, power reasons, that only a priest can anoint. But so if you want a priest to come and anoint you, somebody to come and anoint you, then you have to have a priest. But if you want the Eucharist, then more likely than not, what you're going to get is a minister of the Eucharist.
Basically every time.
Yeah. 80% of the time.
Wow. And so they handle, you know, giving it out, and as you were saying, you found these quote hosts and all over the church. I know some people are talking about that people found them under the pews with gum stuck against them. I know I was hearing about that. It's so just amazing.
One woman told me that she keeps it in her house.
She brings it back to her house?
Yeah, and so she doesn't have to run to church and have somebody get the key for her, or have to find the key, or inconvenience herself. So she, you know, she keeps the quote-unquote Eucharist in her house, and on her way to work, she takes it, and she does her communion rounds, and then keeps it in her car, then she goes back, and she puts it back in her house.
Wow. Do you find that now that you've come to the realization about the counter-church and the Novus Ordo Mass, that you see it differently, such as that if you were to look into a Novus Ordo service, you would have that abhorrence that you wouldn't have had. You would really, it would connect clearly with you what you were seeing when it didn't necessarily connect so much when you were involved with it. Because I know when years ago, maybe about almost a decade ago now, we distributed some information at some Novus Ordo churches in a city about an hour from here. And to just walk in the back of the church, which we had to do in order to facilitate handing out some of the material we wanted to hand out, just looking inside and seeing the presider's chair and seeing the circular setup and the emptiness, it was just palpable that you were dealing with something so spiritually empty, so desolate, that you could feel it. It was just amazing.
Yeah.
And it's just so striking. I mean, I think that's the last time I even looked into a Novus Ordo church. And it was just so striking and empty that I don't know if I'll ever forget it.
Yeah. For the last few years, I actually have walked into a Novus Ordo church, and I have felt deadness. It feels dead to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, like there's no Eucharistic presence. It's just dead, and now you know it's kind of like the lights have all come on.
Yeah, well, that's great to hear.
Yeah, and it really.
And
is.
I'm glad that you know you have the courage to be able to name the names of those who gave you this evil instruction, because one of the big problems we have today is that people are too afraid to name names. People are too afraid to call out the heretics, to call out the people who have done these evil things. And so the evil just gets perpetuated. The heretics don't get exposed. The evil does not get exposed. And so we hear so often from people who don't want to put their names on this or that, or they don't want to, you know, name the person who told them this horrible thing. So it was refreshing to hear that you had no hesitation in simply just telling us and others who actually told you these things, because it's true.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's all true.
Well, that's great. I mean, it's great to hear about your story, and we're really glad to hear about the success in your case, seeing the information and responding to it. And
thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for coming on again, Gregory.
And thank you for having me, brother.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
So until next week, we'll see you again next, hopefully, Friday or Saturday.